Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The headlines are hardly soothing lately. Alleged Islamic terror plots in the U.S., missile tests and secret nuclear facilities in Iran, a big decision looming on more troops for Afghanistan. As senior advisor to U.S. AFPAC Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke, Iranian-born American scholar Vali Nasser is right in the thick of it. And still, he says, look at the big picture and there's hope. This hour, On Point, Vali Nasser on the rise of the Muslim middle class. Joining me now from Washington is Vali Nasser. He's a leading Islamic and Middle Eastern scholar and senior advisor to U.S. Special Envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, Richard Holbrooke. He's professor of international relations at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and a senior fellow for the Dubai Initiative at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. His new book is Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Vali Nasser, it's great to have you back.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Tough message to be carrying when we've seen all the headlines we've seen in the last week. It hardly looks like sweetness and light and milk and honey out there right now. Hard time to be carrying a message maybe about the middle class in the Muslim world.
Well, it's been a hard time to carry any positive message for the Muslim world over the whole past roughly decade since 9/11. But there are two things to keep in mind. One is that the headlines never tell the whole story about what is happening in a vast area as the Muslim world with 1.3 billion population. And headlines definitely don't capture what is brewing underneath the surface and what might be the major trends that will decide the future. And that's not only the case with the Muslim world. We can look at any event, whether it's in the financial arena, other foreign policy events, domestic events. Headlines capture what is happening now rather than what might decide the future. And just like around about 9/11, we had very little sense in terms of the rise of extremism and Al-Qaeda in the manner it did. We are not paying adequate attention to other things that are happening in the Muslim world, and some of them are interesting trends. In particular, we never focus on economics and how it's playing in the Muslim world and what potential it might have. And that's what I'm trying to capture in my book.
You write in Forces of Fortune, and we'll come back to those headlines because they are only the headlines, but they're pretty compelling. But we want to see what you see beyond them as well. You write that since 9/11, the U.S. has come even longer, really, maybe all the way back to the Islamic Revolution in Iran, 79, that America has become perilously close, you write, to reducing everything in the Middle East to the fight against fundamentalism and to seeing every expression of Islam as a threat. What might the United States be observing instead, Vali Nasser?
The fight against fundamentalism is real and it's serious. And I mean to belittle it, and particularly the challenge of extremism and its threat that we see it periodically here in Europe or in the Muslim world itself is also extremely serious. But the question that I raise is that something else that is also happening in the Muslim world is that whenever there has been opportunity, and there is now ample evidence of it, is that there is a prospect for engaging the Muslim world in the field of commerce and trade and help it develop its economies. And that has a transformative effect when it has happened. And therefore, as we think about, you know, how we want to help the Muslim world deal with the challenge of fundamentalism and how do we want to deal with the challenge of extremism, it is important to understand that it is not enough to think in terms of hard power and short-run measures. We also have to take seriously long-run trends that can be very helpful. It is very clear that when you do have a middle class that is integrated into the world economy that relies on a private sector, it is also being a force for moderation, for democracy, and for stability. And in that sense, the Muslim world is not very different from other areas of the third world. that we have seen being transformed by the middle class and integration into market economies around the world.
I wish you'd describe where that middle class has its real impact. I can imagine, for example, when it comes to Iran, a lot of listeners may have images coming to mind as you speak of the post-election time over the summer, where a lot of middle-class Iranians came out in the street and got pretty badly treated. Some got thrown in prison and, you know, beaten and raped and all the rest that we've heard. They hardly look like, in that setting anyway, a really effective counterweight to the Iranian leader who stood at the UN last week and denounced capitalism entirely.
Still, they're the most important counterweight we've encountered in a very long time. And if it wasn't for the Iranian middle class, which is a product of actually a certain degree of privatization of Iran's economy in the 1990s, what we saw during the election and after the elections would have not happened at all. And it's not just Iran. We can look at Pakistan. We can look at examples in Southeast Asia, in the Arab world. And what we see whenever we see a trend that is supportive of cultural pluralism, political openness, better relations in the world, it is the middle class. And we can think of the problem in the Muslim world. Many people in the West prefer to think that the problem in the Muslim world is all religious. I argue that the problem is that there is too little middle class. Everywhere in the world, whether it's in the West, whether it's in Latin America, in China, in India, in Eastern Europe, the force for stability and moderation is a middle class that is integrated into commerce and trade and is gross prosperous and pushes for ideas in the middle of society that help stability and help commerce. The problem in the Muslim world is that in too many places, the middle class is too small, that the pyramid in the Muslim world is very flat. The bottom is very big and the middle class is very small. And in many places, the middle class hasn't quite found its voice. But as we go forward, the real battle in the Muslim world will be over markets, not over religion. It will be the battle for this middle class to become the decider of ideas, politics, and culture. Now, in some places, the battle is going to be stiffer and longer. And we, in our own history, have experience of how difficult and long some battles, like for civil rights, etc., could be. In some places, it's going to be easier and faster. Some countries are closer to crossing the line, like Turkey, Malaysia, Indonesia, maybe even Morocco. And some countries are much farther away from being able to make it to the end line. And there are some countries like Iran or Pakistan or parts of the Arab world where you have an ongoing battle and the outcome is not settled. Even if you took the case of Iran, what happened this summer is only one round in what is likely to be a very prolonged battle for who decides the direction of the country.
But if your view were taken entirely on board, in the here and now, in the day in and day out decisions that get made, whether it's Richard Holbrooke on more troops for Afghanistan, or how to deal right now with the new secret nuclear facilities divulged in Iran, how does this awareness, this perspective, granted the Muslim world is diverse, granted there's a middle class out there that if it were empowered might have a different view of the world, but how would your view change U.S. policy if it were fully taken on board when there's so many urgent challenges right in front of us?
Well, urgent challenges in foreign policy are always going to be there. And they require a different set of policies and reactions to troubleshoot them. But beyond urgent foreign policy challenges, we always have to have a roadmap that will take us to somewhere better altogether. And this is true as much of our relations with the Muslim world as is with Russia or with China. We could always say that there might be a crisis right now which we need to resolve with China or Russia, like over tires or like over missiles in Eastern Europe. But we also have a long-run view of how we're going to stabilize our relations with China. What are we going to be? Where are we going to be together 25 years from now? How we're going to create a framework for better relations? With the Muslim world, for far too long, all we've done is immediate troubleshooting, putting out one fire after another. But we don't have quite the perspective of how can we help that region or latch on to trends in that region that would change the context of our relationship altogether. And I think even if we looked at other areas around the world, that transformation has always followed an economic transformation that has opened up economies and integrated them into the global economic order. And then the global economic order has become the anchor for continued political and economic change and for stable relations between us and that particular region in the world. So I would say that even if these urgent matters you mentioned were to be resolved tomorrow morning, the question persists as to what do we do the day after with that area of the world so that it will move in much more prosperous, stable, and open direction so we don't have to keep worrying about it.
Is there a partner out there for that kind of economic outreach, for some depth of relationship to emerge from that? I think a lot of Americans probably just imagine, you know, a giant Exxon oil tanker pulling in, filling with oil and pulling out. It doesn't seem like much engagement.
No, there is a partner. There are countries that are very close to actually crossing the threshold, and one named Turkey is actually may have crossed. But, you know, when we look at the Muslim world, we often look at the most troubled cases and the poorest cases, and we are looking to prevent the bottom from falling out. But often, and we have to do that, and we must do that. It's absolutely necessary. But sometimes it's also important to help those who are doing actually relatively well and therefore are not in the headlines to become success cases, because then they will help the whole process move forward in the right direction.
Let's get some listeners right in here, if we may. Vali Lee in Boston, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I think it's very important, the discussion on the speaker's information on the Muslim faith and the culture and all the things that's going on in the world about the crisis, economic crisis, and how they could band together and pull together and make an understanding of how they can contribute to progress. I think it's a little far-fetched to say that the Muslims here are part of the crisis. They weren't a part of the crisis in America. They did not cause the crash, the financial crash. So what we need to understand is that the system has to be built from within, that has to do with creating more jobs. And it's good that they are here, but I don't think they contribute to a tax base for middle class to say that our economy will be improved from middle class taxes, because that's sort of far off right now, and we have to reorganize.
Yeah, Lee, we've got the perspective. I mean, you welcome the conversation. Vali Nasr, give us a sense of how, if your perspective were more evident in American foreign policy circles, you know, how might it begin to color what's going on, even in the midst of everything going on right now? The U.S. going to sit down with Iran later this week for the first time, in decades in this kind of talk. The big decision going on Afghanistan. There's a lot going on right now. If it had more of the coloring of your perspective, what else might be going on that's not?
Well, what might be going on would be that we would have a longer-run policy of encouraging countries in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, to open up their economies to international trade, to investment, to deregulate their economies, to create space for business to flourish internally. And I think that's important because when we look at evidence around the Muslim world, if you went to Turkey or if you went to Dubai or you went to Malaysia, these are areas of the Muslim world where the governments actually did open up to the world and followed the examples of Korea or Argentina. Mm. And there you see Muslims aggressively, capitalistically engaged in production, investment, and consumption, behaving very much like middle classes in the West, generating wealth that then the governments live off of. And you don't see a resistance there to integration in the world. And you don't see much interest, actually, in Osama bin Laden's or al-Qaeda's kind of rhetoric for the simple reason that people who have a vested interest in economic prosperity and see a path to prosperity and benefit from trade with the world are not interested in ideas that gets in the way of business.
But is this waiting on U.S. policy? I mean, Europe has been pretty open to trading with the Muslim world. China, very open, even with Iran, right in the midst of everything going on. Is it really American policy somehow that's, is it somehow holding up a renaissance or emergence here?
Well, no. Also, the Chinese and European trade is not necessarily of the right kind. I mean, buying oil and selling big-ticket items to governments is not the kind of trade we're talking about. In other words, when you look at cases like China, India, or Brazil, or Eastern Europe, it wasn't just trading that made things happen. It was also opening those economies to investment from the outside so that then there would be production in those countries that would be part of the whole global trade and production system. So, you know, India opened itself to investment by Silicon Valley in its IT industry that then it produces things that sells back to the global economy. That's not the kind of trade that we have with Saudi Arabia or with Algeria or with or Egypt. So, you know, trade alone is not enough. These countries have to be encouraged and helped with restructuring their economies, removing tariff barriers, changing their currency rules, changing the laws internally to create a business-friendly environment. There's a big difference in doing business in Dubai and doing business in any other Arab country. In Dubai, you're essentially doing business in what is very much like a Western business environment in terms of laws, regulations, government policy. Whereas in the other parts of the Arab world you go, you're dealing with bureaucratic red tape, laws that are not business friendly, laws that don't allow much direct foreign investment. And therefore, those countries just buy finished products and sell certain goods to the world. There's a big difference in the kind of trade you do with different countries.
But what opportunities are you pointing to specifically? I mean, you mentioned Dubai, Malaysia, Indonesia, great. But in the Middle East, I mean, the oil countries kind of have their oil, and it's pretty hard to get around that. Iraq, we're already there. We've seen what's happened there. Iran, not really open to the U.S. Afghanistan, it's about more war and opium, poppies. Where are the opportunities you see as foremost?
No, there are plenty of cases in which the process has started. It hasn't finished yet. Mm-hmm. And it's you're either at the first rung of the ladder, your second rung of the ladder, or some countries are fairly close. There is a certain degree of already opening and integration that has begun in Morocco and Jordan, for instance. Egypt has begun the process. It hasn't gone far enough yet. Even in the West Bank, the Palestinian territories, the government has adopted some very interesting and very productive economic policies that have produced double-digit growth at some periods in the West Bank. And the West Bank's economy has been growing relatively well. And the key for us is to recognize, first of all, that it is possible. So when you look at Turkey or Dubai, you do see that it works, that Muslims, when given an opportunity, actually behave in capitalistic ways and behave in the ways that we want them to behave when it comes to culture, economics, and politics. Dubai, I think, is fascinating because Dubai is a place where Muslims who cannot do business and be prosperous investors and producers and consumers in their own countries go there and become prosperous, productive investors, consumers, and producers. So people from Iran, from Egypt, from Pakistan, from Yemen, they all become you know, the kind of middle class that we want for the rest of the Muslim world where they go to Dubai. So we know it's possible. Now, what made Dubai Dubai? It wasn't oil money. Dubai is actually the poorest of the Emirates in the Gulf. What made Dubai Dubai was that Dubai began to model itself after Singapore. It adopted the right laws. It allowed foreign investment. It became quite liberal in allowing trade in and out of its territory. And it encouraged businessmen to come and set up shop and engage in global trade and do business with Frankfurt, London, New York, and Tokyo. And the result was that you ended up with a mini Muslim Singapore. And therefore, we know it can happen. And we everywhere we see that as soon as the governments do even a little bit of opening up in the Muslim world, we end up with the rise of a middle class. And that middle class immediately we see is interested in consumption. They also like big houses, good education, luxurious cars, travel around, cruise vacations. And what we see is that they become interested in much more moderate views. For instance, when you look at, there is now a whole breed of moderate, business-friendly, modern-friendly preachers in the Muslim world. One of them, for instance, by the name of Amar Khaled, who's an Egyptian by origin and lives in London, you know, gives sermons in town halls or in hotels, dressed in polo T-shirts and relaxed clothing, speaks a very moderate message. Who is his congregation? His congregation is exactly this up-and-coming middle class, which is behaving very much like middle class in middle America or middle class in many parts of the world. It may be socially conservative, it's interested in religion, but it's interested in the world. It's interested in prosperity, it's interested in making money, and is interested in better relations with the rest of the world, because that will facilitate its lifestyle and will serve its economic interests. Now, as I said, it's not, the situation is not that either this doesn't exist at all, or we have to immediately see the final product. We have to realize that in Asia or Latin America, the process did take time. Sometimes it took 20 years before countries made the transition completely. So we're seeing a Muslim world where different countries are at different stages. And we can help the process along if we focused a lot more on the economic dimension of things. And we'll be the beneficiary if the Muslims make that successful transition.
It's an appealing vision. I'm sure some listeners will be thinking back to the middle class folks who were among the hijackers on 9/11. I want to ask you about that, but let me get a call. Chris, Lake Placid, New York, you're on the air with Vali Nasser.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thank you so much. I'm a huge fan of your program and listen to it every chance I get. Mr. Nasser, thank you very much. I believe that the point you're making here is just so important. I am a retired USAID officer, served with our administrator on the post-9/11 task force responding to Afghanistan. And I wanted to ask you your opinion on the Bush administration at the time, why they did not choose to engage constructively on very substantial levels with Muslim countries as a part of our response to 9/11. I had the opportunity to have that kind of a conversation with a very senior NSC advisor at the time working on Afghanistan and made a similar suggestion at the time. And it unfortunately seems to have fallen on deaf ears. And finally, my second part of my question is, what do you think of the recent discussion in the media about a massive solar energy project for North Africa and the European Union? And thanks again very much.
Chris, thank you. Vali Nasser?
Well, the short answer is that I do not know why they didn't make that decision to engage much more forcefully. But what I could say is that what the Bush administration wanted from the Muslim world, which is to adopt more moderate views and move in the direction of democracy, would be much more realistically realizable if it would be based on a solid middle class that is tied to real economic prosperity and is the decisive force in societies. If we look at the rise of democracy in the West or stable democracies around the world, they all are anchored in the presence of a stable, large middle class that is tied to market forces at home and the global economy abroad. So I think, you know, even if it to achieve the goals that the Bush administration would have liked for the Muslim world, it would have been much better to invest more in the middle class and the rise of a economy that was prosperous and integrated into the world economy than to hope to change the politics ahead of economic change. Now, the investment in solar energy is important.
First of all, European investment in North Africa as a source right across the Mediterranean, I guess?
I believe so. Mm-hmm. I believe so. And you know, there are similar talks also about green energy investment in other parts of the Muslim world as well. Obviously, going forward, economic development in the region does need energy and infrastructure. And not every country in the region is oil rich. And in fact, many countries in the region were hurt when oil prices went to $140 a barrel, and that impacted their ability to invest and sustain the rate of growth. So to the extent that the region can develop reliable, non-carbon-based sources for energy, it will help it be able to attract foreign investors, foreign factories, manufacturers who are looking for roads, electricity, and water before they put plants down, and also to serve the interests of the population. But investments of that kind are not a substitute for changing the regulatory environment to help business actually take roots.
Let me get a call from New York City and Joshua. Joshua, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Nasser. My concern is whether or not Islam itself is reconcilable with capitalism in the Western sense, and whether or not a country like the United States or the European powers actually invest, and because the people are concerned, because the leaders need the Islamic identity to hold on to their power.
Joshua, it's a tough phone line, but I think we've got the point, and I've got another caller on a similar vein, Norfolk, Virginia. Carl, you're on the air, Carl.
Yes, I am.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, so thank both you and Mr. Nasser for taking the call, Tom. Wonderful program, as always. I just had some questions. Having lived abroad, Mr. Nasser's concepts are marvelous, except that one of the components that keeps the Muslim world from adopting democracy as America is their concept of the disrespect for their religion, their customs, and that includes the Sharia. Those countries that have succeeded have separated those very clearly. Singapore allows the business world to move in, but they separate business and money. The same has been true for India, and some of the others that he mentions may have dictators, and I don't want to identify them. But I think the key component for both of them is how religion and money.
How they fit together. Carl, thanks for your call. Vali, we've just got a minute before the break, but you're Joshua in New York City raising a question about the compatibility of Islam and capitalism. Right. And Carl saying on the ground, you just don't have the openness to some of the aspects of what makes a capitalist economy run, I guess.
Well, there are sometimes leaders that don't have vested interest in change, and there are plenty of countries that don't have the necessary infrastructure for accommodating business. But this is not a new problem. This is a problem we encountered also in Eastern Europe, we encountered in Latin America.
But is there a cultural or religious contradiction here with the vision you're laying out?
No, because I think that I believe that every religion is open to change, and the greatest force for change comes from the middle class and from money and business. In other words, we cannot look at a religion the way we see it now and say that it will never change. If you look at Western history, if you look at European history, if you look at also how other countries have accommodated culture, the pressure from within to change things comes when people have a vested interest in that change. And Muslims will have a vested interest in that change when the economic force, the market forces push them in that direction.
Sheila in De Poister, New York. Sheila, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question had to do with, I guess, from the top down, is the Muslim middle class ever going to have enough clout to stand up to extremism that has made a lot of people a lot of money and kept them in power? In this country, you know, we have extremism to a certain extent that makes people money and gives them power, keeping people feeling like victims. And as a lower middle class person, I worry about that. And in the Muslim world, that's even more extreme. And I just wondered, is there ever a chance that they'll be able to overcome the power and the money?
Sheila, it's a good question, and we will pick it up directly. Thank you very much for that. Let me get one more in the same line, similar vein, from Los Angeles, California. Saad. Saad, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I take issue with Mr. Nasser's thesis about economic prosperity for the populace in the Middle East is equivalent to a reduction in the fundamentalism. If you take a look at, and you alluded to that, most of the hijackers, the Gulf states, they're all well-to-do, economically very strong, Yet it's a very hotbed for fundamentalism. My concern here is you could be creating a potential pool of donors or financiers for fundamentalist organizations, movements.
Saad, let us pick it up. Vali Nasser, you hear a similar theme of question there from Sheila and from Saad. What do you say?
Well, first of all, to Saad's point, is the wealth is not what I'm talking about. A middle class based on market forces and based on global economy is not the same thing as people who earn money because their government sells oil abroad. There is a big difference between South Korea and Saudi Arabia. One generates wealth, one lives off of wealth that is a given. It's almost like in our own societies, there's a difference between somebody who works and makes billions of dollars and becomes wealthy, and somebody whose grandfather happened to be wealthy and leaves him a very lucrative inheritance. In the first case, in other words, where you have wealth generated, a population by and large becomes dependent on the sources of that wealth. It understands that its livelihood requires openness, requires commerce, requires good laws, and also requires good relations with the world. What you have in many Gulf countries are closed societies with closed economies, with very little entrepreneurial activity going. Money comes from the top that is generated by oil, which is not a productive sector in the economy. It merely comes out of the ground, taken out of the ground by very few workers with foreign assistance and technical support. And then it comes down in the form of entitlements. Entitlements is not entrepreneurship. Entitlements is not that kind of wealth. Now, about the hijackers.
Yes, please. Thank you.
The hijackers who were members of the middle class. Not every, first of all, they came from that kind of background. Secondly, not every single member of the middle class is going to be completely converted, and we can rest assured that there's never ever going to be a wealthy or a middle class person who's a threat. That's never the case. What matters much more is how much of a society will sympathize or follow or has a vested interest in what those few extremists say and do. And when you look at cases like in Malaysia or in Turkey, there's plenty of criticism of American policy. But by and large, the population is not interested in doing things that will end tourism to Turkey or will give the country a bad image. So foreign buyers would not want to buy a T-shirt on it that says made in Turkey, or don't want to buy jeans that are made in Turkey. That desire to give Turkey a good image, because everybody's livelihood depends on that, because that's the source of revenue and wealth, has pushed Turks to adopt more moderate views of Islam. I mean, the current government in Turkey is a moderate Muslim government that is not pushing for creation of an Islamic state, would not like to impose Sharia on Turkey, believes that religion ought to be a matter of private conscience, and is more interested in protecting business links between Turkey and Europe than promoting Islamic ideas.
But Vali Nasser, doesn't Turkey have a unique history? I mean, its national hero, the founder of modern Turkey, was based on this kind of secular approach, as opposed to, you know, many Muslim countries do not have an Ataturk in their historical lineage.
But Ataturk is not responsible for the attitude of the Islamic segment in Turkey. Businesses. When I went to, and this is in the book, when I went to a small town in middle of Turkey that produces about maybe 5-6% of the denim jeans that everybody wears around the world, that makes leather that is sold to fashion houses in Milan directly, I found that the businessmen were deeply religious. They all were mosque-going. They were all family values people. But they all had a direct vested interest in their economic relationship with Europe. The government of Turkey had not given them that relationship. The government of Turkey had got out of their way. So they were doing business. They knew very well that jihad is not good for business. They didn't want that kind of a talk. They wanted, you know, to be able to go to mosque. They wanted to contribute to religious livelihood of their community. But they themselves have adopted a much more moderate view, not because we preached it to them or not because their government forced it on them. It is their market interest, their economic interest had given in a sense that if you're going to be making money selling leather and denim jeans to Levi Strauss or to Ferragamo in Europe, then you cannot be at war with them. You cannot give your products a bad name. So their integration into global economy is what has moderated Islam in Turkey, not Ataturk. Ataturk brought secularism to secular Turks, but those are not the issue. What interests me is not people who are already born secular and already are secular. Mm. What interests me is how much more people who should typically be fundamentalists, people who we would have expected to be becoming more extremist over time, actually went the other way.
Let's get a call from Mike in Griswold, Connecticut. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just finished a book by Naomi Klein that is very compellingly researched and shows that when opening countries to privatization from South America through Europe through even through China, there's been a resulting increase in the number of people below the poverty line. In other words, I think your guest's thesis is very laudable, very hopeful, but the facts show that, especially when the agents of the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank are used, opening the country to privatization actually leads to more of its bankruptcy than anything else. So my question is, what alternative economic mechanism does your guest see that might actually bring about this transformation?
Thinking of Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine there, Vali Nasser?
Well, his thesis is absolutely correct. And first of all, let me say that free market economic policies or capitalism are not free of problems. We saw that in the United States over the past year. They need constant management to balance growth with social justice. And it's difficult to get it right. Sometimes countries fall off the wagon. Sometimes they can do a better job. We have constant debate, whether it's in Europe, in the United States, about what's the balance between generating growth and protecting the poor. Now, in the Muslim world, the problem is not too much capitalism or the excesses of capitalism, is that it's too little of it, or that the mechanisms, particularly of allowing entrepreneurship, innovation, investment, etc., don't quite exist. Now, the Muslim world already, in many parts of it, has enormous amount of poverty, even without the opening of the markets. And the current path on which it's going, it's not helping. In other words, it's going to get poorer and poorer and poorer. Now, the question is, can you open up in a way that, say, Thailand did, or that, say, Argentina did, and be able to, in the short run, manage the impact that it has on the economy with the view that ultimately the middle class is going to be able to generate more wealth and more jobs than the current closed economic system can do. Now, that's something that most countries around the world trusted and did. And now, with benefit of hindsight, we can criticize some of their shortcomings. But there are countries that actually succeeded and came through that process fairly well. I mean, in Southeast Asia, we have a number of successful cases, including Indonesia, which is the world's largest Muslim country, which during the Suharto period about 15, 20 years ago, went down that road of beginning to open up. And it had to deal with the problem of short-run poverty. But Indonesia is doing far better now. And it's actually, despite the presence of Al-Qaeda and the Bali bombings and everything it's gone through, we can see that the majority of Indonesians are openly rejecting extremism. That even though a bomb went off there just a few months ago, that the majority of the population vote for moderate parties, that fundamentalist parties are losing ground, and they are... And the economy is doing better, more jobs are created, society is becoming more moderate.
It makes me wonder if you see the United States as being the vehicle for bringing this middle class rise, or maybe it won't be. Maybe it'll be China, which is not very picky at all about who it trades with and brings trade and market dynamics, even its own capitalism, without democracy.
Well, China is a model, and it's debated to quite a good extent around not only the Muslim world but the Third World as a much more tightly controlled and closed economic model. But the argument is that will China be able to remain a dictatorship indefinitely? I mean, the belief is that at some point, its economic expansion, as more and more Chinese now begin to be integrated into its national economy and China becomes a larger global economic player, that ultimately a closed political system cannot accommodate China's growth, and at some point it's going to become, it will have to open up, even if not to full democracy, to greater openness than is currently the case. And in fact, that becomes a very strong argument for why you ought to get the economic side right, why you need a middle class first, why you need an middle class to be the engine of growth before you can have successful political openness. But where the point you make is important. China does not have the same kind of concerns we have with the Muslim world. And therefore, China does not need to look at the rise of a middle class or the rise of capitalism in the Muslim world as anything more than an economic partner. Whereas we have a greater demand from the Muslim world. We would like to have a better relationship with it that would make us more secure and more comfortable. Mm. And therefore, we need to sort of look at the middle class not just as somewhere where we can make money, but as a force that can push the region in the right direction. Again, not it cannot get there overnight, or it cannot solve all of our problems. But it's very clear that where the way things have moved in most of the Muslim world so far have not been something that's been satisfactory to us. And there's plenty of evidence that if the middle class had a greater voice, we would have fewer concerns.
Saeed in Green Bay, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Vali Nasser.
Yes, Mr. Nasser, the fact that your central thesis is correct was nowhere better in display than post-election Iran, where a emerging coalition of women, young people, and labor stand poised to transform Iran to post-Islamic government. My question is, and what I'd like to understand, is how American policy is promoting or retarding the realization of the aspirations of this emerging middle class. In the package of proposals presented by the Khomeini's government to the Obama administration under political and security issues, a central thesis they ask for is, I'm reading verbatim, consolidating the national sovereignty of countries in the framework of democratic practices. And what that translates is that Iran would like to the current regime in Iran would like to define or be left alone vis-a-vis its practices of suppressing its own populace. Now, this our current policy of détente with dictators does not promote the emergence of this middle class.
Vali Nasser, President Obama reads your memos. What do you say?
Well, and this is not just limited to the case of Iran you mentioned. It applies to many other Muslim countries, and also a dilemma that we've confronted in other parts of the world, going all the way back to our relations with the Eastern Bloc and Soviet Union during communism. We have to find the right balance in terms of how do we deal with countries in the short run and how we try to support positive ways that they can develop in the long run. I think that, you know, going forward, what I would like my book to suggest to policymakers is to give a lot more attention to the forces that can decide the future, and for us to be able to better balance what are short run objectives with and short run priorities and urgent issues we have to deal with a perspective for the long run in terms of ways in which we can put various countries on a path that in the long run they would end up in a more open, prosperous, and culturally diverse place that would be better for all of us. But this is a kind of perspective that we need to have with the Muslim world, because whether it's Iran or it's the Taliban or it's the general sense of extremism or it's this larger issues of anti-Americanism we deal with.
May I ask you, we've just got 30 seconds here, but sure. Do you think we're going to have enough relief from, let's say, war, Afghanistan, or conflict, Iran, to actually act on this? And we really just have a few seconds here. Do we have the clearing to do what you're suggesting?
We are powerful and resourceful enough to multitask. The question is always for us to see the problem and to see the solution and then build an approach on that basis.
Vali Nasser's new book is Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. He's at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, a senior advisor to U.S. Special Envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, Richard Holbrooke. Vali Nasser, joining us from Washington, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.